Thank you. You may be seated. So I'll welcome everybody to the Second Court of Appeals for our second oral argument this morning. And I understand the attorneys have checked in and are ready. I'll remind the record of our panel today. To my left is visiting Judge Ruben Gonzalez. To my right is Justice Wade Birdwell, and I'm Elizabeth Kerr. And with that, I will ask the clerk to call the case. Thank you. You may proceed.
Good morning, and may it please the court. I recognize there were some problems with the microphone earlier. I will try to have my voice up, but if I don't, I trust you'll let me know.
Thank you.
As I said, my name is Niles Illick, and I have the pleasure this morning to represent Deidrick Headley. We presented four issues on appeal today, and I intend to address each one in turn, not all of them in the same duration, but I'll address them in the order in which they came up. And the first one is an issue in which Justice Birdwell and I have talked before, and that is the concerns about the qualifications of the jury. And I have acknowledged Justice Birdwell's
well-reasoned opinion.
Yeah, beautifully written opinion. And I still don't know how to pronounce it, Njogo.
Njogo or something of that nature.
Right. And yeah. It holds against me, but it is an unpublished opinion, and I do think there's some distinctions to be made here.
You are making a distinction, the attempt to distinguish, that this is somehow a constitutional issue in this appeal,
yes,
where
Justice
that was
Birdwell.
Simply just a purely statutory objection.
Yes, sir.
And
as you're explaining it, we issued a decision in early October, the Bonilla-Rubio case.
Which was my case, right.
Yes, I think that maybe discussing both of those would be helpful to us.
I think they all come out against me. I can't somehow get this issue out of my head, and maybe I should. But I think there are two distinctions that exist in this case that don't exist in both of them. And if I may address them first from error and then to harm, the error being, and of course co-counsel has argued, as he's right to do, that they must show affirmative evidence in the record that the qualification wasn't done. And here we ask the court to look to volume 4, pages 20 through 21, state cites to exactly the same place. And what we see is a question asked about qualifications, a question asked about oaths, and what we get from the reporter is a parenthetical answer, unintelligible multiple speakers. Now we ask the court to contrast that with the answers that come up a little bit later, pages 21, 22, where it says, affirmative group response. And we ask the court to recognize there's a distinction and a difference between unintelligible multiple speakers and affirmative group response. So when they're talking about qualifications, we get this unintelligible multiple speakers from the reporter. That's in 2021, volume 4. And then later on, we see this affirmative group response when everyone in the panel is saying yes. And I think those are different. So that's one thing we didn't see in Bonilla-Rubio, the Njogo, not in there. The second thing, going to Justice Birdwell's question, is that we've raised this in the context. We've asked the court to view this as a constitutional issue and not just a statutory issue. If it's just a statutory issue, there's no chance I can win, right? I can't possibly show that one of these jurors, I can't go investigate them, I can't go look into them, I couldn't bring that in anyway. I can't possibly win. So I've had to bring it up in the context of Constitution. And the reason I brought it up constitutionally, and I think I can raise it constitutionally, is that I don't think anyone's going to argue that my client, any defendant, doesn't have a right to a fair trial. And a right to a fair trial means a right to an impartial jury. If you had a juror who is not qualified, who is up there because that person has been demonstrated to be patently, to be a dishonest person through a conviction for theft, or they're under indictment by the same DA for theft, we get into a question of whether or not my client had a had a fair trial, had a jury that that allowed him to be tried fairly. So we're raising that as a constitutional issue. If the court sees it as a purely statutory issue, which I can understand, and that's how it's been addressed in the past, I lose. It has to be a constitutional issue. That's my first issue. I recognize that.
So are we dealing with the right to a jury trial in a criminal context? Is the constitutional provision you're relying on, or are we relying on due process?
I think it's the right to a fair trial, which comes up in due process.
So I have a question for you now. If you're talking about the distinction between statutory and constitutional, what kind of scrutiny are you asking for then? What type of analysis, if they're differentiated? Is there a difference in the analysis?
Sure. Thank you, Judge Gonzalez. I don't know if Judge or Justice Gonzalez. But
it's just Judge.
Okay.
I serve here at the pleasure of many.
Okay. I don't want to be disrespectful
You're
in any way.
Thank you very much.
Judge Gonzalez, I think that's a good question, and it goes to the essence of why I'm arguing this as a constitutional issue, and it's 44.2 A and B. A puts the burden on the state, and B puts the burden on me. And I cannot satisfy it as a statutory one under B. I just can't. But under A, they can't satisfy it. So the scrutiny of who it falls on, neither one of us can prove, can carry our burden. And so the question becomes then who it's on. If it's statutory, it's on me, I can't prevail. If it's constitutional, it's on them, they can't prevail, and the error is harmful.
Did you brief what the appropriate analysis and how we reach A or B?
I did not, Judge Gonzalez, with the idea that, and I've just been before this court a lot, and my understanding is that the distinction between 44.2 A and B would be familiar enough to the court that it didn't require me to distinguish the two. I certainly talked about it being 44.2 A and being constitutional error. I did not talk about what it would have been had it been 44.2 B.
Let me ask you one other thing. One of the things you point out in your discussion with regard to, and I'm going to want the state to answer this too, one of the things you point out is that there's no way for you to figure out whether somebody in the veneer is currently under a pending indictment, okay? That would be information that is exclusive to the state, to the prosecuting authority. All right. And if, in fact, there was somebody who was, in fact, under a pending indictment and they ended up on the jury, then under a Fifth Circuit case, In re Dretke, that would be presumed bias and create real difficulties with regard to whether or not due process, because having somebody in deliberations who may be influenced by the fact that the prosecuting authority may go tougher or less tough on them, that's a real problem. The problem I see, though, is that's a remedy that we don't have the authority to impose upon the state, that they've got to present all that information with regard to each and every member of the veneer so that you've got it, so that you can make a record. That's something that we don't have the authority to do.
Yes, Justice Birdwell, and I need to move on to my second and third one after I answer your question, but that's why I have to raise this as a constitutional issue. I simply can't. You know, a lot of the names are too common. Even if I wanted to go do it and somehow argue that it was in the record and somehow demonstrate that a juror had this, I can't do it. We can't make the state do it. What we've got to do is show that it infringes on his right to a fair trial. If it does, then the burden falls to the state. I don't think they can carry that burden, and we would prevail on that issue.
How would they meet that burden?
I don't think they can. I just the same way I can't meet my burden if it's purely statutory. It's impossible for me to meet. The burden's an impossible burden if it's statutory, right? Because I have no way to go back. Let's just say a juror's name is Rob Jones. I'm making that up. I don't want to give a juror's name in public court, but let's say it's Rob Jones. How could I ever show that this was the Rob Jones who had an indictment or conviction for theft from North Carolina from 1992. I couldn't do it because the name is too common. I can't go back and ever prove my burden. I don't think they can prove theirs.
If we agree with you, presumably we would have to establish some sort of bright line test going forward for how the state can avoid the constitutional issue that you raise. And so in an ideal world, what would have happened so that your client got a fair trial on this point?
I think that the responsibility, and it's a sua sponte responsibility, it sits with the trial court judge to come in and make sure that these jurors are properly qualified. Before I begin, I need to make sure. Have any of you ever been convicted of theft? Have any of you ever been under, or any of you currently under indictment for theft? It's not a high burden. It's not a difficult thing to do, but it is an important thing to do, and it needs to be done, and we don't see it being done. We just trust that it's being done down in the main courtroom. We trust that it's being done by someone else. We have no evidence of it, and it just continues to bother me that it is. But I need to turn, if I may, to issues 2, 3, and 4 very quickly with the 4 minutes I have left. Issue 2 goes to authentication. I'm going to be a little bit quick here because I think the court's familiar with the issues of authentication. We have 2 videos in State's Exhibit 35. One of them is by the homeowner. One of them is by a different homeowner. There was an objection to it. The trial court permitted it in. The state asked this court to rely on Cortez, an unpublished case out of Corpus Christi. I think Cortez will be different because there the witnesses testified they were familiar with the content of the video.
Didn't the homeowner testify that the neighbor's video showed what he himself had seen?
What he himself had seen, but he did not testify that the video was unaltered or unamended or unchanged. He couldn't do that. He didn't know that.
I guess he could have theoretically if the video showed something different from his own recollection of what he saw.
I'm not sure I understand the question, Justice Kerr.
Sorry, probably a bad question. So, I mean, if let's say that he remembered exactly what he saw, and the video from the homeowner shows something
a red
different.
Car and a blue car.
Yeah.
Type of situation.
Right, right. So well, then when he says this video shows what I remember seeing.
Sure. And what I'd like to say to that, Justice Kerr, when I was thinking about this, maybe I'll tip my hand a little bit to what I did this weekend, but the NFL, when you watch an NFL replay, you see one camera that shows maybe a foot in bounds, and then you have a different camera that shows it out of bounds. So you sitting on one side may think that you see the foot in bounds, but when you look at it from a different camera, a different angle, you see something different. So unless these two are identical and there was no purpose at all for the state to put this in, which I don't think is true, then they show different things, and there's some sort of Venn diagram where this homeowner could testify
But didn't your client testify that, yes, he was in that alley and he had a gun, and the only thing he disagreed with was that he had pointed it at the officer?
He did.
A hard time understanding how this would be a harmful
error. That gets us to the question of, did it have an effect or only a slight effect? I have only 2 minutes left. I'd like to rely on my briefing on that issue, and I'm sorry to rush through this. Four issues is a lot to argue. But our third and fourth issue mercifully are tied together, and this goes to the important issue of whether the evidence was sufficient and whether or not the jury charge got it right. And I would like to kind of address those together because I think they do. And the real question here is that we have this penal code definition of peace officer, and I'm not going to read it to the court. The court, it's in the briefing. Everybody agrees on it. The definition in the jury charge was incomplete, and State kind of equivocates on that, but I think ultimately they agree that not all the words in the penal code were in the jury charge. Now, the state asks us to get around this by taking judicial notice of the fact that the city of Aubrey was incorporated. Now, I think their principal authority for that is the Payne case that comes out of the Court of Criminal Appeals in 1980 or 81. Now, the problem with that is that we have Rule 201, 201F of the Texas Rules of Evidence, which says that in any criminal case, a jury must be informed that when a court takes judicial notice, that it is not conclusive, that the jury may accept that or they may reject it. Now, Rule 201F came in 1998, which is 17 or 18 years after Payne. And if we, if not we, I'm not on the Court of Appeals, if the Court of Appeals will then take this issue away from the jury, they're doing an end run around 201F. They're saying, we're going to take judicial notice of this. The jury doesn't get a chance to reject that. 201F doesn't matter. So I think there needs to be some harmonization between Payne and 201F, and Payne can be distinguished because of that.
Mr. Rich, was that instruction given that they could disregard the judicial notice?
No, Judge.
It was not in there.
Judge, no. And the judicial notice that I'm talking about would be judicial notice by this court, not by, and I see that I'm out of time. May I answer your question?
Please.
The judicial notice that I'm talking about would be judicial notice by this court, as opposed to the trial court. If this court takes judicial notice, then of course the jury never gets the instruction that they could reject the court's judicial notice. I hope that's clear.
I understand.
In my argument.
My question, though, at the trial level, was that instruction given that the jury could disregard the judicial notice by the trial court?
No, no.
Thank you.
Thank you for your time.
Thank you.
May it please the court, my name is Rick Daniel. I represent the state in this matter. I was going to start off with issue number three, but I want to cover issue number one first quickly, just to hit that couple areas that y'all seem to be concerned with. Concerning the jury impanelment, there's preservation of error under 33.1, and then after that, you would move to whether or not there was overcoming the presumption under 44.2C. And then after that, the next step would be, okay, is this a constitutional or statutory under 44.2A or B? And then lastly, you would get to the Code of Criminal Procedure 44.46, where you would have to show significant harm in the end result. So we're not arguing at the beginning that as a preservation of error, we're not arguing that in preserve error, we concede they have the right to appeal. But if they're going to appeal, they're going to have to overcome that presumption.
How does a defendant make a record that somebody in the voir dire and potentially on the jury was under a pending indictment without access to that record?
Sure. The first step would be to ask during the voir dire, but the second would be potentially in a motion for new trial to ask the court, did you or somebody under your direction ask these questions, and get the answer to that one first. That would be step one.
If I may.
Yes.
In the full record, is there a copy of the jurors' names and date of birth in the full record? Did the trial court preserve that as part of the court reporter's record? Do you know?
I do not know about the 12.
The voir dire.
Now, I believe that would be, I think that would be sealed and that would have to be unsealed, and I don't know that it was unsealed in this.
Isn't it possible then that the respective parties could go back and verify if there was a convicted felon or a person that does not qualify to sit as a juror in those circumstances then?
I think after the first step of, okay, the judge didn't ask these questions, then you would go to the next, okay, we need to look at the jury now and find out if anybody served on it that has a conviction, because you're going to get to that 44.46 part where you're
going
to have to.
You can find out if there's a actual harm.
Yeah, so you're going to need
I'm not talking about conviction. I'm talking about
a charge.
A pending indictment, which is the third, the third thing under 3516. It's not just a matter of conviction for theft or felony. Mm-hmm. Below that immediately is pending indictment or prosecution of some kind with regard to a theft or felony. And so a conviction would be a matter of public record. An indictment might not be in that regard.
That's where you're going to have to go into develop a record during a motion for new trial. During that time period, you're going to have to develop the record to find out if anybody was convicted or under indictment that served on the jury. That's when you're going to need to do that to get over that presumption and then to get to the next point. And the next point I wanted to point out was
just add one
in regards to, yes, sir.
During the designation of the record, isn't it possible for the supplementation of the veneer and putting that information into the record is part of the motion for a new trial?
I would think so, yes.
Yes, it would be, I believe.
Yes.
Thank you.
The next step in the process would be whether it's statutory or constitutional, which was an issue that y'all raised earlier. And I would point the court to Gray, the Court of Criminal Appeals case, that was a similar situation. In that case, a judge excused a veneerman for economic reasons. And the court held that that was an error. They violated a government code statute. And then the determination of, okay, well, is this going to be constitutional error because it affects the Sixth Amendment, or is this going to be a statutory area? Are we dealing with 44.2A, or are we dealing with 44.2B? And the court pointed out that a lot of our statutes are in place to protect the Sixth Amendment, but that doesn't make it a constitutional violation. And the court held that it wasn't a constitutional violation, and that you would look at these violations of these statutes concerning the qualifications of jurors, excusing jurors, all these things that affect a fair trial as non-constitutional harm analysis under 44.2B, not 44.2A, which would allow you to get to the 44.46 analysis on the Code of Criminal Procedure, where a case isn't reversed unless there's showing of, unless there's objection during the trial, before verdict, or there's a showing afterwards of significant harm. So, other than that, I agree completely with Justice Birdwell's opinion on Njogo, and then
incredibly well-reasoned,
the beautiful,
opinion.
Beautiful,
yes,
well-reasoned beautiful opinion in Bellino, Rubio, and we would ask the court on the first issue to overrule appellant's first issue. Now, jumping to the third issue, the one that I consider probably the most confusing would be the sufficiency of evidence based upon the argument that the state didn't offer evidence of incorporation of a city. The defense argument is basically we offered evidence that, and the record reflects that we had an officer testify that he worked for the city of Aubrey, but no one testified to the further step of, okay, Aubrey is incorporated. And under that, I would want to bring to the court's attention six different cases on this court taking judicial notice. First of all, there's Payen, which is a 2006 published Court of Appeals case, Rios, 2008, Corpus Christi unpublished opinion, and then Thomas, which is 2010, Court of Appeals out of Houston, again published case.
Are there any are there any municipal entities that are unincorporated in Texas that are referred to as cities?
That I don't know. I looked at that, and it's possible to have a city.
Is there such a thing as an unincorporated city?
I tried to answer that question, and I could not find a definitive answer. If you're, they're different terms, so that, and there's both in the code, city, incorporated city. So I, in theory, I think there could be a city that's not incorporated, but I don't know of any in Texas. So,
well, there's
really
the subsection that says incorporated city, and then the very next subsection says municipality. And those have very distinct meanings. That's why I'm, is, in other words, is incorporated kind of just an add-on word, or does it actually, is there, because if there's no such thing as an unincorporated city, mm-hmm, then it's just describing the same thing.
I couldn't answer that, so I went a different route, and I'm kind of going to get to that.
Well, there are citations, I think, in the defendant's brief for other code sections that talk about unincorporated cities.
Okay.
So
there's the three.
You can have an unincorporated city.
Okay.
The three Court of Appeals cases, and then two Court of Criminal Appeals cases, Vasquez and Gonzalez, 1984 and then 1987. Gonzalez overruled the portion of Vasquez that held that appellate courts couldn't find judicial notice of incorporation. So that one, and then the last one is Payne, which is the 1980 case that has similar facts to ours, where a Houston officer testified that he was a police officer. It was a ag assault of a peace officer back then instead of ag assault of public servant. And the officer testified that he was a, if there's a definition of peace officer, And then the officer testified that he was an officer with the city of Houston. There was no testimony about it being incorporated. The Court of Criminal Appeals in Payne, 1980, said the better practice would be for him to say Houston is incorporated, but we can take judicial notice of the fact that it is incorporated, and we do take judicial notice of the fact that it's incorporated. They held that there was sufficient evidence. And that's similar to what the courts had been doing since 1920s. They would routinely, Court of Criminal Appeals, Court of Appeals would take, appellate courts would take judicial notice of incorporation. Then 1980 is Payne. Moving forward, 1984 in Vasquez, the Court of Criminal Appeals all of a sudden said, 13th District Court, you're in error for finding judicial notice of Three Rivers being an incorporated city. It's without really any explanation, they just said they were in error, and then affirmed it based upon a different, it was an arson case, and there were different means of proving the arson, and they affirmed it, the sufficiency of evidence, under another route after they found that it was, they were in error for finding incorporation.
What about defendant's argument about the later enactment or adoption of the evidentiary rule that says a jury can decide to ignore something that a court has taken judicial notice of? Are we in the best position to be doing this, or should it be the trial court?
Well, my answer to that question involves the next case of Gonzalez. Under Gonzalez, Vasquez held that they can't take judicial notice. And then Gonzalez in 87, 3 years later, is kind of the case on appellate courts taking judicial notice of incorporation. And we're just talking about incorporation. And in that opinion, they went through the three different types of ways a city can become incorporated: by special charter, general law, and then home rule. Three different areas that they can become incorporated. They went on to analyze the civil statutes that make it mandatory for courts to find judicial notice and not require proof of incorporation under the civil statutes. And then in that case, they held that as far as San Antonio goes, because they had recorded their incorporation, it was mandatory that the appellate court find judicial notice for San Antonio. Now, after Gonzalez also pointed out that, number one, there doesn't have to be a predicate laid in the trial court. That was an argument that was made in Gonzalez and addressed, and they said, no, you don't have to make any type of offering at all. You don't have to offer the charter, you don't have to ask for judicial notice, you don't have to do anything in the trial court in order for the appellate court to take judicial notice of incorporation.
I have a question for you. So under the circumstances you're describing, and you're talking about judicial notice and being able to talk about it, almost elemental fact that needs to be established about being in the confines of the city or not, if a judge, a trial judge, does not instruct the jury that they can either adopt what the judicial notice made by the trial court is not contained within the instruction, is that fatal? I mean, to the logic that the jury is sitting in the box and they can simply say, you know what, we disagree when we're actually deliberating. I don't want to take the judicial notice, and that was something they didn't satisfy beyond a reasonable doubt, and therefore the case fails, and the jury returns a verdict of not guilty. Do you think that that is a serious issue or not?
No, in regards to the jury making a determination, because the case law is that under the civil statutes, once it's incorporated, that there's no requirement of proof of incorporation.
You're not addressing my question.
Well, the next part of it is that there's that, and there's also 2118 of the Code of Criminal Procedure, which says if it's something they have to incorporate, if they have to take judicial notice of, you don't have to plead it. And then you also have the case law saying that it's not required for the state to offer evidence. So it's not required at all under those statutes and those cases for the state to offer evidence during the trial of incorporation, just the incorporation.
So it's basically not an element.
It's not an element.
if it can just be, you're almost talking about a presumption, I guess. If a police officer says, I work for the city of X, then the requirement that it be of an incorporated city is just out the window.
You would have to prove up under the statutes and the government local government code and the case law of Gonzalez and the following case law that In regards to that specific part of incorporation, there's not a requirement of the state offering evidence. And that's where the three Court of Appeals cases, all three of them, without addressing whether or not the city was special charter, general law, home rule, without addressing which one, all of them say, we may take judicial notice of incorporation. It is not required by the state to present evidence of the same.
I have a question for you with regard to the instruction or during the conference, the charge conference. Did the defense request the instruction to be given regarding that the judicial notice can be disregarded by the jury? Did the defense request anything along those lines?
No, Your Honor. No. Okay. With those three Court of Criminal Appeals cases, then
doesn't it just basically boil down to, in terms of the judicial notice, whether or not there's a fact issue for a jury to determine? And if in an appellate court, based upon public record, can make a determination that there was no fact issue because, in fact, the incorporation or lack of incorporation is a matter of public record, period, end of story.
Which ties into the language in Gonzales that if the facts are easily determined by with certainty from number of sources, then the courts are allowed to take judicial notice, of, which is also in the judicial notice rules of evidence 201. Same language was in Gonzales, it's in 201. And it kind of ties into also there's a Court of Criminal Appeals case in regards to just reasonable inferences from the evidence. It's in my brief as Ledesma, in which there was a stipulation. It's another peace officer type case by the Court of Criminal Appeals. In that case, there was a stipulation of evidence. Stipulation of evidence didn't have anything about incorporation in there. Despite that, the court said that based upon all the evidence, it was reasonable for a jury to infer that the person knew that he was being arrested or stopped or whatever by a peace officer, based upon all the evidence presented and the reasonable inferences from that. So I don't think the incorporation element would prohibit not having evidence of incorporation, that specific word would prohibit the basic reasonable inferences from the evidence analysis. So I would ask the court to overrule appellate's third issue, and then I'll roll kind of into the fourth issue, the instruction of the jury of peace officer. The jury was instructed that a peace officer is someone who is elected, employed, or appointed as a peace officer, and it stopped right there, which is the same thing that's in the pattern jury charge. There are other cases. There was a case out of Corpus Christi where they went on beyond that and said a peace officer is someone who's elected, employed, or appointed as a peace officer under 2.12 of the Code of Criminal Procedure, and then didn't explain 2.12 of the Code of Criminal Procedure. In that case, Favela, they held that that definition was error. There's also a case out of El Paso, Morris, where they had just the definition of peace officer is someone who is employed, elected, or appointed as a peace officer in their charge. And that court held that because it was limited, it was narrow interpretation of a larger statute, it wasn't something that misled or confused the jury, it was not in error, it was sufficient. Might not have been the best, but it was sufficient. Versus Favela, where you went on to go beyond that point, adding things that you've now got to define, and you didn't define them, that's going to be error. The main part of Favela is that, similar to our case, there was no contesting or disputing or arguing about whether the person was a peace officer. Mr. Hadley testified, said he knew he was a peace officer, said that his only defense was that I didn't point the gun at the police officer. So the element of peace officer was never really contested in this trial or brought up. There was no objection also to the court's definition, so there would be no egregious harm. Favela would be a very similar case to ours in regards to using for analysis of egregious harm. And I would submit that the definition, maybe not the best, but is sufficient and would not be an error. Alternatively, if it is an error, if it's incomplete, then they haven't met their burden of showing that it was egregious harm. And I think based upon the facts of this case, it definitely wouldn't be anything that would cause the defendant not to have a fair trial. So we'd ask the court to overrule appellant's fourth issue, which leads only the authentication. Before I get to authentication, concerning the first issue again, I'm sorry to go back, but what I was referring to in my brief was on page 21 of volume 4, the court said, thank you very much, you can put your hands down. Did they go through your qualifications downstairs? And then in parentheses, it's affirmative group response. So I'm not sure where the unintelligible, negative, affirmative confusion comes in. When I'm referring to it, I'm referring to that specific question by the judge and that specific answer by the panel. The authentication, one thing that I want to point out with a little bit of time I have left, obviously an individual can authenticate a videotape by saying, I was there, I personally observed the scene, this fairly and accurately depicts the scene. It's been that way since 1988, or 1998, I believe, with Angleton overruled Kephart. Kephart had these 7-prong tests that you had to do for audio with video. Since then, it's just 901, in this case, B1, where you have a person that testifies, I was there, I saw it, this accurately reflects it. We have that and more in this case. We have that statement that I saw what was in the back alley and this accurately reflects it. Then we have the same witnesses testifying, I reviewed State's Exhibit 35, the surveillance videos on there, both fairly and accurately depict what I observed. And then you have the further evidence that he testified at the same time that they were not altered or deleted. There was testimony of that. He did at one point on cross-examination testify that he didn't know whether they'd been altered or deleted, or because he didn't know about the other person's equipment. But there has been evidence to establish that it was properly authenticated.
Thank you very much. Rebuttal.
May it please the court. Very quickly, I'll turn to issue 3, and I think Justice Kerr hit the nail on the head with this, with the issue of taking judicial notice is really something the trial court should do. So the trial court should say, we're going to take judicial notice that the city of Aubrey has been incorporated. And then you put it in the jury charge of you're free to accept this, you're free to reject it, but we've taken judicial notice of it. It gets to a wonky, weird position where this court is asked to take judicial notice of something, and then the jury is never given the opportunity under 201F to accept or reject that. And the reason we're in this position is because 201F comes in after cases that talk about judicial notice, and none of the cases the council has talked about reconcile 201F coming in after Payne and those cases. So there is this uncertainty and this tension, and I think it invites the court to an opportunity to point this out and to clarify it for the, I don't know how many counties are in this district, but there are quite a few. Let's get this right. This is how it should be done. If you're going to have this issue, because we see this charge a lot, it's not some random charge. We need to see you do it in this way. This is the right way to do it. That doesn't mean you have to come out in my way. I hope you will. But it's an invitation, an opportunity to tell the judges how to get, and the attorneys, how to get this right.
Can a jury, based upon that instruction, make a determination that something that is blue is actually red?
Well, Justice Bodwell,
the trial court tells them this something was blue, and then they give them an instruction that basically says they can ignore the trial court with regard to that?
Yeah, I mean, that's the system we live in, is that we allow the jurors to deliberate in private. We don't monitor their deliberations, nor am I saying we should. They're free to accept or reject any evidence they receive. They can reject a video that says a car is blue. Now, that may not be rational, and that may create some problems, but we allow the jurors to accept or reject any evidence that they receive. And we, as judges and as attorneys and as people who are deeply interested in getting this right, may find that troubling, but I don't know of a better system. And so I think, yes, a jury could come in and say, the court has told me that Aubrey is incorporated, but I don't have any evidence of that, and I don't know what that means, and I don't accept that the court, forgive me.
I need to ask this. Okay. I understand the distinction you're making about in the record with regard to unintelligible versus multiple affirmative answers or group affirmative answers, okay? But the unintelligible answer that's in the record is clearly a response to the trial court's question, were you qualified downstairs? Okay? So the trial court is, the record reflects the trial court is asking whether or not something that should have been done under its direction was done downstairs by people under its direction, and the trial court appeared to be satisfied that it had been done, because the trial court then doesn't try and do something that he's concerned, that the trial court's concerned about. Okay? So the court moves on from that. That's in the record, appearing to be satisfied. And there's also no objection. In other words, defense counsel didn't say, hey, Your Honor, they all said they weren't qualified. How about you go ahead and qualify them now? So why are we not in a position like we ended up being in Nojo to basically say the record reflects here that in fact that inquiry was made whether or not qualifications were done, the trial court asked that question, was satisfied with the answer, and the record reflects that, so that an unintelligible record is not necessarily disqualifying that in fact it was done.
The unintelligible answer?
Right.
Okay.
The fact that the record says the answer was unintelligible, yes, does not negate the fact that the trial court appeared to understand the answer.
I just needed that clarification. I only have 11 seconds left. If I may answer that question.
Sure.
Justice?
I defer to...
Yes, you try.
Okay.
Wrap up your thoughts.
No one's ever told me no before on that, but I think it's polite to ask.
You can answer the question.
I think that the critical thing, Justice Birdwell, in this case, as in every case, is to go back to exactly what is in the record. And the part that we are discussing, I'm sorry, I had it right here. The judge says, I should have said this at the beginning, is there anybody that did not take the oath when they were downstairs? Okay, when they qualified you. Then it comes to unintelligible. So I think that the judge is talking about the oath more than the qualification there. So I think it would be very difficult to say, your premise is that, if I understand you correctly, your premise is that at that point he was satisfied that the jurors had been qualified. And I reject that premise, and I ask you to also, on the ground that the question is really about whether or not they took the oath. And I hope that when you go back and read that, you'll agree with me on that. Now, preservation, frankly, I'm surprised it's not a bigger issue here. The attorney at the end said he had no objection to this. And the only way I get around that is a type 1 Marin issue. And I didn't even argue that.
Thank you, Mr. Illich. In deference to the fact that we have a visiting judge, he would like to ask a question, so I'm going to extend the time a little bit.
Thank you.
Okay. So what you're describing in the unintelligible, you have both parties there, including the judge, that poses a question. Had there been any dispute whether or not there was somebody that was ineligible, doesn't it make sense that the parties are going to bring it to the attention of the judge as well as the trial court? They're going to see somebody out there saying they're not eligible. To believe that the unintelligible response or what's placed in the record defies common sense, I think, to a degree, because the trial court is watching what's going on. I believe most trial courts are honest, as well as the participants there. Isn't there a presumption that had there been somebody that's not eligible, the parties would have responded accordingly?
And Judge Gonzalez, thank you for the question. And I would ask that the issue is, I think, very similar to the one I was discussing with Justice Birdwell, in that I think when we read the question very closely that was asked, the question is about an oath, and then they put at the end, okay, when they qualified you. So he's talking about, is there anybody that didn't take the oath when they qualified you? And then that you get this unintelligible answer. And so I I disagree with you respectfully, and I think that I would ask that you look at that and you say, either I agree or disagree, but I think it comes down to that really fine grain reading of the transcript in that respect.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Justice Kerr.
Gentlemen, your case has been submitted. We appreciate the oral argument. It's been very helpful. And with that, we stand adjourned.
Thank you.